Thank you, Kendall, for that nice introduction. This is really a collaborative work among a couple ARS labs, the Hydrology Remote Sensing Lab in Beltsville, and I see Bill and Kustas in the audience, as well as the AIAT lab in Ames, Iowa. What was formerly up in Parlier, and now I'm down in Riverside. And so what I'm going to focus on talking about today is basically partitioning eddy covariance fluxes directly into evaporation and transpiration fluxes. And many of the models we use calculate evaporation transpiration separately. And so for validation purposes, the eddy covariance method really, if we can get outputs directly for evaporation and transpiration, that would be extremely advantageous. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on a determination of the FAL56 coefficients and motivation for some of the alternate methods of determination. I'll talk about the mechanics behind the eddy covariance flux partitioning approach. I'm going to focus on the basal crop coefficient and the stress coefficient, not so much on the salinity, or not the salinity, the evaporation coefficient using flux partitioning, as well as evaluation against a couple eddy covariance sites in contrasting crops in Maui and Central California. So this is old hat for the vast majority of people, but irrigation is the 800-pound gorilla of water use for fresh water. And it's expected to change due to new technologies and increased use of degraded water alternate irrigation methods. And the FAL56, which Rick Allen and others helped develop, is the standard approach for calculating crop ET and relies on a reference ET equation combined with, if you use the dual crop coefficient for soil, the basal crop coefficient for well-watered plants, and stress coefficients. One of the issues is that there's a lot of parameters in with the dual coefficient method that has a lot of parameters that can have significant uncertainty. Cultural practices for irrigation are changing all the time. And so what we need to do is have a way to constrain the coefficients for new crops and new practices at a production scale. And so what I'm going to focus on showing with these eddy covariance data is data gathered from towers that are in production fields that we have other ancillary observations that can rapidly determine and constrain coefficients. So eddy covariance is perhaps the most widely used micrometeorological method for determining ET. It has a pretty good size spatial footprint compared to lysimeters. And from the perspective of my work, it can be a lot easier to install in cooperating growers' fields. You're not digging up a big pit to put in a large weighing lysimeter. Towers can be relatively non-interfering with field operations. But as many of you know, eddy covariance just provides a total ET and does not separate out the transpiration and evaporation components. And so to do this, we need to use other approaches to further partition fluxes. So what we can do with eddy covariance data, and particularly high-frequency eddy covariance data, is to use the correlation structure of the high-frequency data combined with plant water use efficiency to directly partition photosynthesis and respiration and evaporation and transpiration. And this was based off of a methodology was first developed by Todd Scanlon at University of Virginia. Bill Kustas has also helped with developing this method. And the plot on the right isn't so important, but my take-home point is that the using correlation structure is significantly easier to implement into the existing structure of eddy covariance towers, and it's a lot less costly than other approaches. And the key parameter, which sort of links plant level plant physiology with the field scale eddy covariance, is the water use efficiency and the calculation of intercellular CO2. So the way we do this is with a correlation structure program that analyzes the high frequency, the 10 to 20 hertz data from the collected by the eddy covariance instrumentation. We run the correlation structure, function comes to convergence for the 30-minute period. And what we do for a day is we sum the latent heat components, the evaporative and transpirative components, and normalize the total fluxes to develop daily fractions of evaporation and transpiration. And using these daily fractions, we can calculate the crop coefficients as shown in the lower right. So I'm going to present data from two different regions. I'll just briefly go over them. They're both semi-arid, heavily irrigation-dependent regions. One is a drip-irrigated sugarcane plantation in Maui, which has sugarcane is a C4 photosynthetic pathway crop, very unique two-year production system, relatively unique in that not much sugarcane is drip irrigated, and so it provides a good parameterization for the water use, a good test for the water use parameterization in the C4 species. When we were doing the study in 2011-2012, there was very little precipitation at these sites, less than 100 millimeters. Kauai was in a drought, and these are on the leeward side of Maui. And then for contrasting a different type of crop, we had a furrow irrigated peach orchard in the Central Valley of California near Kingsburg. And this was furrow irrigated, but it was a mature peach field, so they had varying leaf area cover over the furrows. This part of California, as many of you know, is going through an extreme drought. During wet years, they can get most of their water from surface reservoir or surface river diversions. During dry years, they pump, and pump some more. And so there's so this power has been running since spring 2012. And I do want to mention that reference ETs in Maui, we had our own custom calibration for reference ET. And in California, we used the Penman-Monteith parameterization from the spatial CIMIS network, as George introduced in his presentation. So with our sugarcane, the KC shows a predictable trend, increasing to peak maturity, and then as the crop ages, it starts to decrease. It also shows a peak during the winter period, and the local cultivars, the current local cultivars show a slightly different mean value than the tabular values in FAO 56. In the peach field, we see the transition that you can get with an orchard crop with a sudden leaf out. KC increases very, very quickly with leaf off. Again, this is a mature peach orchard, about 5 meters in height, and leaf area can change very rapidly. In 2014, the farmer's well ran dry mid-season. And so the farmer had some substantial water stress issues, and went, even after they got the new well drilled, they couldn't quite get back up to full irrigation. During the well watered years, the peak KC is about 1. And at the sugarcane site, our PCB time and stress coefficient tracks KC very well. and it illustrates the small impact of soil evaporation at the site. I didn't I'm not showing the KE values, but it's by the end of the by the middle of the growing season, KE was less than 0.05. This is drip irrigated sugarcane. After about 10 months, there was a good layer of dead sugarcane leaves, what they call trash on the ground, which would suppress soil evaporation. In the peach field, KCB was generally stable during 2012-2013. The running means that look very odd at the beginning and end of the season. That's when we're having before leaf out and during senescence, and that's when our canopy energy dynamics are more unusual. The one advantage with the flux partitioning is that it can be used to constrain some of your modeling parameters. For instance, at our from our Hawaii site with a 20 centimeter depth soil volumetric water sensor right in the heart of the root zone. And this is basically showing with a volumetric water content versus the combined coefficient. And it's showing no relationship, which basically means it's further supporting and further indicating we are in the well-watered zone for the for this crop, that we're not seeing a significant drought stress coming in. So one of the advantages is that this could potentially be used to help improve satellite parameterization of fluxes, particularly given that a lot of some of the satellite ET algorithms rely on regression relationships between crop coefficient and satellite vegetation cover indices such as NDVI, EVI. In his previous presentation, George showed an example of a vegetation-dependent index SIMS that doesn't account for energy balance. And one of the things that's sort of nice about this is that if you have an environment that could have significant soil evaporation, this might be a way to improve your satellite parameterizations and modeling. So some future work that we really need is the intercellular CO2 parameterization is a weak point. I mean, right now we rely on published plant physiological relationships between atmospheric and intercellular CO2. There's some evidence that the relationship not only varies between C3 and C4, but also within different plant species. We're currently working on evaluation of the fluxes against sap flow measurements, but other comparisons against other independent techniques like microlysimeters, isotopic fluxes would be needed. We need some more sensitivity analysis. And integration of canopy rainfall for locations with significant rain during the growing season. Both the Hawaii site and the California site had extremely low or non-existent precipitation during the growing season. California, if it rains in June or July or August, something is up. And so the potential applications would be for rapid assessment in novel production systems. This could complement existing lysimeter-based approaches, and this would also allow for evaluation in farmers' fields. And then also to relate, this could allow for better relationship between actual ET and to remote sensing and low-cost in situ sensors, such as regional relationships between alternative reference ET approaches like atometers, and to also can be integrated potentially with new technologies such as UAVs. So in summary, flux partitioning is a potential tool to assess crop coefficients at a field scale in new production systems or new irrigation approaches. It shows a strong potential for relating coefficient model parameters to satellite and in situ soil data. There's a lot of future work that's needed to reduce some of the uncertainty with flux partitioning and to validate in multiple systems and against other independent methods. And the approach would be potentially substantially cheaper than large weighing lysimeters. And thank you for your time and attention. And if there's time, I'd be happy to take some questions. We have to vary the anemometer height above both crops because they grow. I mean, the peach orchard probably grows from about 4.5 to 6.5 meters during the course of the season. Then they basically prune it at the top, and the sugarcane went from 0 to 4 meters in height. We try to keep the sonic anemometers about 3 meters above the zero plane displacement. We didn't calculate, in California, we did not calculate the reference ET using the data from the tower site. Hawaii, we had to because of some other issues with some infection issues, and so at Hawaii, we used the log profile to scale the wind speed from 3 meters to 2 meters for reference ET calculation. Dr. Allen.
Yeah, that seed ratio they use, do you use a constant value during the daytime and into nighttime?
For intercellular to atmospheric CO2?
Yeah.
The initial parameterization and this is where the C3 versus C4 came from, because the C3 was 0.7, intercellular CO2 was 0.7 times atmospheric CO2. For C4, it's like 0.44. There's evidence to suggest that the intercellular CO2 is also a function of vapor pressure deficit, so we are testing that algorithm too. And this is where the we have at our peach orchard sap flow sensors on the trees, and we're also augmenting with some other additional soil moisture instrumentation to try to get some independent validation. But that analysis is ongoing. We still have leaves on our trees in the orchard in California, so the season's not quite over yet. In Hawaii, it was excellent. It was basically the sugarcane plantation in Hawaii is on a wind tunnel between two mountain ranges, and so the trade winds get funneled through there. And I had a paper that it was about 95% to full closure at the Kingsburg at the peach orchard. On a daily basis, the closure was about 85%. And we did adjust the ET fluxes for energy balance closure, but in Hawaii, it was a negligible adjustment because we had wind speeds of over 5 meters per second even in nighttime.
Our next order of business is to conduct the community meeting for the ET measurement and modeling community. And so if you don't have an urgent need to be somewhere else, it won't take very long, I promise. There are really two things on the agenda. The first thing is to elect or appoint or volunteer yourself for next year's leadership. Next year's community leader will be Xiaomao Lin from Kansas State University, and I believe he's presiding over another session currently. This appointment typically is 2 years, and so the first year you would be a vice leader, and then the second year the community leader. They work pretty closely together to try to arrange these sessions for the annual meeting. It's some work. It's not a lot of work. You decide what type of symposia you want and try to get speakers in if you're trying to create a large symposia. And once you get applicants to speak, then you arrange them in whatever way you need to. We also have some base funds that we use for a graduate student scholarship for their talks and their posters, and so that's another thing that we support. Dr. Ray Anderson has volunteered himself, and if somebody else would like to volunteer too, I suppose we could have an election, but is there any opposition or anybody else that would like to be a part of it? Congratulations, Ray. Thank you. Thank you for your service. Really appreciate that, and I'm sure Ray will do a good job supporting this community. The second item and last item is I would like to seek feedback from all of you regarding what types of symposia or what types of special sessions you would like to see at the annual meeting next year. This symposia was created specifically based on feedback from last year's meeting. So if there are certain things that people would like to see, please speak up. I think that was a great feedback. Thank you, Steve. And I think maybe as a suggestion moving forward, if we had a session like this, I mean, there's six papers here, but I think it's important that we continue to encourage people to present these types of papers. Perhaps we could make this one an annual thing. I don't know if that would be something we'd want to see every single year, because I know sometimes people will repeat a lot of data, but... any other suggestions? I know there's a lot of modelers in the room too. Any thoughts from? Okay, Ray. Well, I'm sure you'll come up with some great things for next year. So, is there anything else anybody'd like to bring up miscellaneous in regards to the meeting? Last year we gave everybody beer and they left. So. Not everybody left, but it didn't seem to make people stick around too much. So instead, this year we caught you in the middle of a session and trapped you. So if there's another way to get more people to the meeting too, that would be fantastic. But I really do appreciate all of you sticking around. So unless there's anything else,
how's the budget of the community?
The budget's doing fine. I mean, we're staying pretty steady. I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but. We haven't spent a lot compared to what we had before, so we're in good shape. We are going to be handing out some student awards, but we got supplemental funding for that this year.